Will and Kelly, is it good to be back? Will and Kelly Momsen, we are delighted that they have come back to Wichita after a little stay in Wisconsin. It would be hard to imagine two statements in the Bible more different from each other than the two I would like to use this morning. One comes from the Gospel of John in the New Testament, and everybody who goes to church has heard it. But the other comes from such an obscure book in the Old Testament that many of us will never have heard it at all. I'd like to introduce this second one by recreating a scene from the immensely popular cereal known as MASH. I am so skeptical by nature of TV sitcoms that I discovered MASH later than most people, but I liked it when I finally watched a couple of shows. And one night, as I passed through the room that has the television set, I heard Father Mulcahy, the likable and somewhat muddled priest for MASH, talking to wounded soldiers as he walks through the field hospital. He comes up to the bedside of one boy who is reading the Bible and smiles at what he takes to be proof of devotion to religious faith. Then he reaches over in obvious delight to take the Bible out of the boy's hands, and he begins to read out loud. "How beautiful are your sandaled feet, O prince's daughter. The curves of your thighs are like jewels, the work of skilled craftsmen." His face about now begins to turn red and look worried, but he plows on. "Your navel is a rounded goblet. Your belly is a heap of wheat. Your two..." He stops reading aloud just in time for that show and this audience, and he hands the Bible back to the soldier with some little joke, which I have forgotten. Some of you would have known already, even before the scripture Roy read this morning, that those verses come from the Song of Solomon, sometimes called the Canticle of Canticles, or the Song of Songs, which is some ancient editor's way of saying that the love poetry in this book is incomparable. The other biblical comment, the one from John, is also about love, but the language is calm and prosaic, with not a single image which could be called erotic. "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, to give up life for the sake of a friend." When the Song of Solomon talks about love, the poetry is filled with rich and sensuous imagery, as first of all the physical beauty of the bride is explicitly described, and then the masculine beauty and strength of the groom. He says to her, "Your parted lips behind your veil are like a pomegranate cut open." And already it sounds like an ad for Revlon. "Your love is more fragrant than wine. Your lips drop sweetness like the honeycomb. Your dress has the scent of Lebanon." And Lebanon was famous for its fragrant cedar trees. "How sweet is your love, how much better your love is than wine. And on he goes, intoxicated by the beauty of his beloved. When Christ talks about love, it is in a brief, simple statement which he delivers to his disciples the last time they are together, when he is trying to sum up for them what he thinks is the heart and soul of his message. In one way, you could hardly imagine two passages more different from each other, but in another way, you can say that they are simply variations on the same theme, and the theme, of course, is love. Or you may wish to object to that and say they are really about two different kinds of love, and in some measure, you would certainly be right. Because the Song of Solomon is openly and unashamedly about the sexual love of a man for a woman and a woman for a man, while Jesus is talking about the kind of love that leads one human being to lay down life, if need be, for the sake of a friend. But they have more similarities than you might think, as I will try to show a little later. A great many people have pointed out what a pity it is that in the English language we have only one word to use for both of them. Life, they say, is confusing enough as it is, and it would certainly make for greater clarity if we could distinguish better between sacred love and profane love, or sexual love and brotherly love, or to use a couple of words the Greeks had, between eros love and agape love. And yet there may be a kind of unconscious wisdom in our English use of only one word, love, to describe them both, because at their deepest level, they are more nearly one than they are two, both expressions of a single deep human impulse. But to understand how they are one, we first have to see how they are two. Something is obviously very different in the Bible about the Song of Solomon, or it would never have been such an embarrassment to those men who tried to explain a long, long time ago why this extraordinary little book ever happened to wind up in the canon of sacred scripture. If you read about the councils in which Jewish scholars debated which books were acceptable and which were not, you quickly discover that the Song of Solomon almost drove them crazy. They could see that it was a very frank glorification of physical love, yet somehow it had long ago become part of the Jewish library of cherished books, and it had Solomon's great name linked with it. So what were they to do? How could they take what is obviously a torrid love song and make it a part of the solemn books that would make up their sacred scripture? They talked about it a long time. They talked about it heatedly. And finally, they found a solution. And it may be the greatest single travesty ever perpetrated on a biblical book. They decided that this erotic love song was, after all, nothing more than an allegory, an extended and elaborate metaphor that was attempting to depict the love of God for the Jewish people. I know of no better proof that the human mind can always make itself believe whatever it needs to believe. If you go home today and read that book carefully, in a clear modern translation, so that you know exactly what is being said, I think you'll agree that only desperation would have tried to change those steamy images of physical beauty into safe and respectable allegory. But by saying that all these frank anatomical descriptions are really meant to symbolize God's love for the Jewish people, those ancient editors at least saved the book for inclusion in the Bible. And then a little later, when the Christians came along, they found this same allegory device very useful once again. The Song of Solomon was still an allegory, but now it was an allegory of Christ's love for the church. They never quite get around to explaining why spiritual affection should be described in such spicy anatomical language, but they found this useful, and so they made that argument. Christians like Saint Jerome were just as embarrassed by this frank and uninhibited piece of love poetry as the Jews had been. The great translator wrote a letter one day to a certain lady about her daughter, a letter which will give you some insight into Jerome's mind. He said, "Let her never look upon her own nakedness. She should not read the Song of Songs until she has read Chronicles and Kings, for otherwise she might not observe that the book refers only to spiritual love." Well, he was right. Only someone dulled almost into a stupor by trying to get through Chronicles, a boring restatement of what is better told in the book of Kings, perhaps in some ways, particularly in matters of style, the most boring book in the Bible. But only a person who had almost lost consciousness reading that book could possibly fail to see that the Song of Solomon is about exactly what it appears to be about, a glorification of physical love. Jerome was a 4th century man, but there have always been, in every century, some who felt as he did. At the end of just the last century, a churchman at Salisbury Cathedral, writing in a popular commentary on the Old Testament, said, "Such a book as the Song of Songs may not be fitted for public reading in a mixed congregation, or even for private reading by the impure in heart." That may deter some of you from going home to read the book this afternoon, but the others should do so. We are not quite so likely to blush nowadays as the Victorians were at almost anything. But you will still go to church for a long, long time before you will hear anybody read all or probably even a part of the Song of Songs from the pulpit or the lectern. I want to borrow some thoughts from Frederick Buechner, my personal choice as the finest preacher in America. I said earlier that we would try to see how the two kinds of love are different. So let me read again the image we heard at the beginning. "How sweet is your love, my bride. How much better is your love than wine." It's as good an image as any for the kind of love that is sometimes known by the Greek word eros, the word which gives us the adjective erotic. The speaker is saying that he loves her because she brings to him an intoxication, a joy which without her he cannot have. There have always been people who were embarrassed by the body, even though when God created male and female and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply," he pronounced his judgment that this was a good arrangement. There is a subsequent story in Genesis that has a tree of knowledge and a talking serpent, but which, on a level above that colorful folklore, seems to be saying that when people elevate their own wills above that of God, their relationship with each other, including its sexual dimension, is also distorted. Instead of remaining an expression of their joy in each other, their eros love becomes a way by which each can use and dominate the other for his or her own purpose. And that, the biblical writers say emphatically, is always wrong. The physical love celebrated in the Song of Solomon is certainly erotic, but it is not mere lust. Lust and love are often confused, one having sex as its only object, the other including sex as one of the many ways of expressing itself. Love wants to enjoy in other ways the human being whom it has enjoyed in bed. But in the morning, lust is always furtive. It dresses as mechanically as it undressed and heads straight for the door to return to its own solitude. Like anything that can be truly called a sin, it makes us solitary. Love is involvement. Lust will not get involved. If love is continuance and involvement, it is also attention, so that one may come to know the other on many different levels of personhood. Lust is not capable of this constancy. It has no attention to give beyond the short attention span governed by its own desires. This is why so many thoughtful people have pointed out that if erotic love is not also agape love, it never leads to union in more than a fleeting way. Sexual attraction creates for the moment an illusion of union, yet without love, this union leaves strangers as far apart as they were before, sometimes makes them ashamed of each other, sometimes makes them hate each other, because when the illusion has vanished, they feel their estrangement from one another even more markedly than they did before. The words essentially are those of Eric Fromm, who knew something about this topic. In Buechner's thoughtful language, our society is filled with people for whom the eros relationship is one where body meets body, but where person fails to meet person, where the immediate need for sexual gratification is satisfied, but where the deeper need for companionship and understanding is left untouched. The result is that the relationship leads not to fulfillment, but to a half-conscious sense of incompleteness, of inner loneliness, which is so much the sickness of our time. He sums it up by making the point I wanted to make from the beginning. In other words, eros, the love that seeks to find, and agape, the love that seeks to give, spring finally from the same deep impulse of the human heart, which is the impulse to be one with each other and within ourselves and ultimately with God. I'm not sure such beautifully sensitive and thoughtful comments as his have any chance against what most of us see in television and in movies, but they need to be spoken and they need to be heard.